We all know the difference between a house and a home. A house might have a proper bed and locking doors, but it's never as easy to get to sleep in someone else's house as it is your own home, right? We all have felt that before. I remember once staying with my grandparents as a youngster, and that first night in San Bernardino, I just remember staying awake hour after hour with the lights on. There were too many sounds. There were too many unknowns that made me worried. They were my grandparents, sure, but it wasn't my home, right? Home is a place of peace and provision and rest. In our text, Elimelech's family is rocked by a series of terrible tragedies. And after all the burials are over, Naomi and her daughters-in-law have to decide where is home, where home is going to be for their future. Where will they find the rest that they need for the short term and try to cobble together some sort of future in the long term, which in the moment looked absolutely bleak? We watch in dismay as Naomi tries to stop the ladies from moving back with her. We know that's exactly where they need to go, and yet she's convinced that she should go alone. Meanwhile, the Lord is quietly, graciously, faithfully beckoning all of them to come. Come find the rest that seems out of reach in their temporal circumstances. You, Naomi, and yes, even you Moabite ladies, come and experience the rest of God through the hesed love of God. Are you safe at home? I don't mean a house somewhere in Hanford or Lemoore. I mean your life, your heart, your future. Can you join with Moses, who prayed and sang in Psalm 90, Lord, through all the generations, you have been our home, our refuge, the place where we find rest for our souls? Does your soul have a place it can rest? In this text, we see God inviting his daughters home. And of course, Jesus gave all of us the same invitation, not geographically, but spiritually. He said, come to me, and I will give you rest, rest for your souls. In this text, we see God inviting his daughters home. And so let's take a look at home and rest and how we can and should accept the Lord's invitation. Verse 3 begins, Naomi's husband Elimelech died, and she was left with her two sons. The grass looked so green in Moab in the first two verses, or at least the grain looked so golden. But the dream quickly became a nightmare. Naomi's husband, her provider, the leader of this family, died. Was this a judgment from God? Well, the text doesn't say, but we have to conclude that the move to Moab was a disaster. To be buried in an unclean foreign land was considered a terrible fate for an Israelite. And our narrator uses a really strong term when he says Naomi was left. It's a term that can refer to someone who survives an elimination process, or it can refer to the residue that remains. She's left. We think, oh yeah, she's left, you know, he's gone. No, she was left like a residue after an elimination. Naomi and her sons are left bereaved, cut off from their extended family, from their clan, from their tribe. They are left to fend for themselves. And we see here how the book now is presenting Naomi as totally responsible for this family. She is the head of the household now. She's in focus. It says, Naomi's husband, her two sons. That seems like a small thing, but that's a really unusual way for ladies to be referenced in the Old Testament. Usually all of that falls on the husband and father, but he's gone and now she's it. She's responsible for this family. It's all on her shoulders. Unfortunately, there's not a lot that she can do. Ladies at this time, they couldn't just go out and become breadwinners. They couldn't just fall back on skills they had learned before. They were, by and large, dependent on husbands and fathers. But what this illustrates for us, and this is an important thing for us to always remind ourselves, our life choices impact the people around us. That might be a silly thing to have to remind ourselves of, but it's true, and we need to tell ourselves, the choices that I make, the words that I say, the decisions that I move through, those things impact the people around us. You know, God designed humanity to be connected, not isolated. We are not creatures like the Middle East blind mole rat. It's known as the ultimate introvert. They dig a tunnel system about a foot underground. They spend their whole lives there. If another mole rat accidentally tunnels into the home of another one, there's often a deadly battle. Get away from here. They want to be on their own, isolated, in the dark, not bothered. Humans were not made for isolation. They were made for community right from the very start. Friendship, partnership, society, marriage, all of these different relationships, they bring not only advantages and opportunities for us, but they also bring us responsibilities. In every relationship that you have, if you're a Christian, you have responsibilities toward those people. God's word speaks to us about our responsibilities, our duties as people, as husbands, as wives, as parents, as children, as citizens, even as adversaries. If you're a Christian, you have responsibilities towards your enemies, Jesus talked about. Your life choices do not have consequences only for you. They impact many lives of the people around you, people who God holds you responsible for you to love and to serve and to support at one level or another. Now, Elimelech made this choice. He clearly thought it was right for his family, but it did separate and isolate them out from their extended family, from their clan, from their tribe, from the people of God at large. And we're seeing some terrible ramifications of this choice. Self-centered choices lead to damaged lives around us. And even in the church, we are called to community, we are called to unity, we are called to relationship, not isolation. We live in a time and culture where it's popular for some people to say, well, I'm the church wherever I go, and so I don't need to gather, I don't need to be connected with other people, I'm just this free-floating Christian. I'm just this free radical in the body of Christ. Well, free radicals are a bad thing in our own bodies. Severed limbs and severed digits are bad things in our physical bodies, and they're just as bad in the spiritual body as well. And so we can't be making self-centered choices and thinking that it's not going to have negative impact on our own lives, on our families' lives, and the lives of the people around us. Verse 4 says, her sons took Moabite women as their wives. One was named Orpah, and the second was named Ruth. Hold there. Why didn't Naomi and the boys go back to Bethlehem right away? So Elimelech dies, and then some amount of time passes, and they say, well, we're just going to stay. Clearly, it wasn't only Elimelech who didn't trust God anymore. So Elimelech, we can hang the decision to move to Moab on him. He's the leader of the family, and he says, all right, there's not enough food for us in Bethlehem. We're leaving. We're crossing the Jordan. We're not in the promised land anymore. We're going to Moab. We're going to settle there as resident aliens. That's on him. But now he's dead. So the decision to go to Moab is on him, but the decision to stay in Moab is on Naomi. She clearly was no longer trusting the Lord either. She continues with this ill-advised plan to integrate with Moabite society. Now listen, it wasn't specifically unlawful for these boys to marry Moabite women. There's a passage in Deuteronomy where there is a list. He says, it is illegal for the people, as far as the law of Moses was concerned, it is against the law for you to marry your sons or daughters to Canaanite spouses. Well, the Moabites aren't technically Canaanites. They're outside the land. It wasn't specifically unlawful, but it was definitely, obviously, against the spirit of the law. But Naomi and her sons, they're still acting like the people of Judges. Remember, that's the whole backdrop for this book, in the time of the Judges. And the time of the Judges is defined by one thing, people doing what's right in their own eyes. And so they do the same thing. In fact, our narrator here uses a strange term when he says they took these women as wives. It's a term loaded with negative connotations. It was last seen in Judges 21 where women were kidnapped to be wives. Now, were Orpah and Ruth kidnapped? I don't think so. But our writer and our narrator here is specifically using a word that is not the normal word for, oh, they fell in love and they got married. No, he's using a negative word. They took wives from the Moabites and at least wants us to think somewhat negatively about their choice. But here, finally, after, you know, a couple of verses, we are introduced to the lady herself, Ruth. Now, Bible names mean things, and often they are very important to the story. So what does Ruth's name mean? We don't exactly know. There's no certainty to what her name means. In fact, some scholars will say it is the most obscure name of the entire book. But scholars generally feel it means something like friendship, or maybe well-watered or fertile. It could also mean refreshment. And she is indeed one of the most refreshing characters of the Old Testament. But we're not exactly sure what her name means. And I kind of like that, because it's like, who this figure, who we know the book is named after her, okay, who's she going to turn out to be? How is she going to turn out? Is she going to turn out to be a positive character or not? Of course we know, but as we're reading this, he's drawing us into the mystery of this lady who seems, okay, she seems like an interesting lady based off of her name, but we're not so sure about her. Verse 4 continues, after they lived in Moab about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and the woman was left without her two children and without her husband. So after another decade, even more tragedy hits the family. These two boys' names mean things like to be sick or to be finished, he's a goner, or frailty or sterile. And you know, they seem to live up to those names, not only because they died young, but look, after 10 years, neither of them had any children. That would have added significantly to the family's social and economic worries. It's a problem in this society, in this time, if you don't have any male heirs, especially if you have no male father. I mean, they're in real trouble, economically speaking, and for what's going to happen in the future. Now, for Naomi, this is obviously a terrible, crushing blow. Obviously, there would be her perpetual grief at the loss of these men in her life. But on top of that, she's lost everything. She's lost everything. Her husband is gone. Her sons are gone. Notice how verse 5 refers to her as the woman. It doesn't even refer to her as Naomi, just the woman. It's as if she's even lost her identity. Everything's gone. She has no connections, no prospects, no skills, no hope in that land, no standing in their society. Once again, she is left like the residue after a terrible fire. What's going to happen for Naomi? Verse 6, she and her daughters-in-law set out to return from the territory of Moab because she had heard in Moab that the Lord had paid attention to his people's need by providing them food. And so suddenly, a light shines into the darkness. In the shadow of death comes a message of life. How did she hear about it? How did she get this message? Now, we don't know the particulars, the logistics. You know, we don't know who came and sent this word, but this book is a story of providence. God's working through real circumstances. God's working through human history to accomplish his good will. It is the story of a Lord who loves his people, who sends the good news to those who need it, the good news of his loving act of grace so that they can hear it. That's the work of God throughout every generation, to send the good news of who he is and what he's doing on your behalf so that you can live and not die. God's tender kindness is right there in verse 6. That phrase, the Lord paid attention, it speaks of God's visiting his people. That's what it means, that he visited them with care and concern. The first time that term was used in the Bible is all the way back in Genesis 21, when the Lord visits Abraham's wife, Sarah, and does for her what he promised. He gives her a son. He gives new life to the family of Abraham, life that eventuates in blessing for all the families of the earth. Through that family came life for all of us, the delivery of the Messiah who saves the whole world. Now remember, Elimelech and Naomi left Bethlehem because of a famine. They didn't think the Lord would take care of them and provide for them. And now, when we finally see God do something, what's the first thing God is doing in this book? He's doing the very thing they thought he could not do. The thing they didn't trust him to do, here he is doing it. They were wrong. He was faithful. He does watch out for his people. He is mindful of their difficulty and their suffering. He does work through human situations in order to accomplish good on behalf of his people. Now, for their part, the Moabite ladies decide to go with Naomi. Notice that they set out too. They set out to return. Now, this is remarkable because they're doing the flip side, the opposite of what Elimelech and his family did in verse 1. And Elimelech and his family in verse 1, they say, we're leaving the land of promise where our God is because we don't trust him to provide for us, and we're going to go to the land of the Moabites. And here we see these two ladies, these Moabite women, doing the opposite. We trust your God to provide. We're going to go to your land, and we're going to live there because he's going to take care of us. They are giving up their community, their culture, their gods, because they believed something about the God of Israel. Now, we don't know exactly all that they had heard or all that they understood or all that they believed about the God of Israel, but it was enough that they were willing to devote themselves to him, to trust him, to follow him, to go where he was calling them to go. Verse 7, or rather, let's pause before verse 7. So we don't know exactly what the ladies knew, but Naomi's testimony and Elimelech and the boys, they clearly had told them something about the Lord. And while that testimony must have been muddled and compromised, since this family really wasn't trusting the Lord, not in a real way, clearly Naomi had taught these ladies something about the truth of God. Verse 7, she left the place where she had been living, accompanied by her two daughters-in-law, and traveled along the road leading back to the land of Judah. I'm struck by how simple the path back was for them. Not that there weren't any difficulties or dangers or that it didn't take some work and some planning, but notice they don't have to, you know, cut through a dense jungle to find their way. They don't have to blast through mountains. They don't have to row overseas. They don't have to discover a secret map in order to find their way to this lost city or something, right? It's right there. There's the road that leads you home. It just kind of reminds me of the yellow brick road. There it is, right? Just follow it. It's right there. It's going to lead you exactly where you need to go. The road leading back to the land of Judah. You know, the Bible uses this image of taking a road to speak about the course your life is on, my life is on. The history books of the Old Testament, they will use this term to evaluate whether a king of Israel or Judah was good or evil, what road they were on. The prophets and the wisdom books use it to speak of moral or immoral paths. Psalms opens with this image of the road that we're on. Is it the road of the righteous or is it the road of the wicked? And so what path are you on? What path is your life on? Jesus explained in the Gospels that there are two roads that we can take. One is broad. It seems easy to walk on. But the end of that yellow brick road leads only to destruction. The other road is narrow, but it leads to life. And Jesus says, man, walk the narrow road. Here it is. Let me show you where it is. You can walk it. And he went on to say that he is the way that leads to life. And the Bible is given to us as the lamp for our feet, the light for this path, so that we can know how to walk it. So we can know how to stay on the road that leads home. It's laid out right there for us. If you have drifted away from God, or maybe you ran away from him, if you find that you're off path, that the trajectory of your life is not headed down that biblical straight and narrow road, Jesus Christ, well, then the fix is simple. The road's right there that leads back home. Repent. Turn back to God. That's what we see pictured by Naomi. The whole time they could just pack up and step onto the road and head back home. They knew it would lead them there. Just return, come back. You know where you're supposed to be, so get moving. You'll have to make some progress. It will take some time, but just turn around. Turn back to God and start walking with him. The story, which has been so bleak so far, now depicts Naomi moving in the right direction, and we're so excited for her. She's heading home. And we know it's not just going to be a place where she'll be a little more comfortable, but we know, oh, that's where God is. That's where providence is. That's where rescue and salvation for your future is. And she even has this little mixed multitude with her, two Moabite women. You know, when the Israelites came out of Egypt, they didn't come alone. They came with a mixed multitude, meaning people who weren't Israelites, but who believed in the power of the God of Abraham. And they said, hey, we're going to go with you. And so Naomi's leading this tiny little exodus, just the three of them, with this mixed multitude. And we're so excited. This is going to be great. And then we have verse 8. Naomi said to them, each of you go back to your mother's home. May the Lord show kindness to you, even as you have shown to the dead and to me. May the Lord grant each of you rest in the house of a new husband. She kissed them, and they wept loudly. Oh, no. Here are these two women who love Naomi, who have some measure of faith in the God of Israel, who are willing to forsake their culture, their family, their paganism. And Naomi says, get out of here. Just go. If you're thinking that's reading too much into it, we're going to see this play out like one of those movie scenes where the kid has to tell the animal, go on, get. And they're, you know, he's like trying to. She works hard to unload these ladies, hard to send them away. Hard enough that it's hard to watch. We'll find that even though she wants to benefit from the provision of the Lord in Bethlehem, she's very angry at God. So she knows that Yahweh is providing for his people in Bethlehem. She's going because, hey, what am I going to do? I have to get some food. But we're going to find that she is angry at God. And she seems to be trying to excuse herself from her responsibilities and this very precious opportunity to rescue two needy women from paganism. She says, I don't want to have you around. You need to go back home to your mother's homes. You know, in the next verses, notice how she's going to call them my daughters three times. And for the rest of the book, she keeps referring to Ruth as my daughter. She knows that God has brought them into this relationship, that you are my daughters now, and that responsibility and that fellowship that they should be having. But what do we see here? Go back to your mother's home. And so in this moment, even though she knows in her heart that God has connected their lives together, she says to them, you know what? I'm not your mother. Not right now. Go find a mother. Go back to your mother's home. I want to be free of my responsibility of you. I want to be free of this opportunity the Lord has brought me to bring you into fellowship with him. And it's a sad moment. Now, she tries to dress it up with spiritual talk. May the Lord show you his hesed, she says, right? God's faithful covenant love. May he show you hesed. May the Lord grant each of you rest, she says. But this is not a heartfelt prayer. This is a phrase used in a technical sense to end a relationship. She's saying, we're done. And I'm using these formal things to say, we are done. I am concluding my relationship with you. And may God's hesed love be with you. And may God give you rest back in Moab in the home of a new husband. Now listen, not only was hesed a specific and loaded word, rest was also a loaded and meaningful word to the Israelites. Because God had come to them when they were still the family of Israel, before they became a nation. He said, look, I am going to find and give you rest. It's a specific word. He said, I promise I will give it to you. It is not in Egypt. It is not in the wilderness. It's on the other side of the Jordan. And the Lord would use that term specifically as a place of peace and happiness connected with their covenant with him. And additionally, one commentator writes, the term rest summarizes all the qualities of an ideal marriage in which a godly woman can find strength, security, material well-being, and love. There was no hesed in Moab. And there was no rest on that side of the Jordan. Because there is no rest apart from covenant with Yahweh. You can't find rest if you're not in covenant with God. This is why Jesus says, I'm bringing you the blood of the new covenant so that you can come to me and find rest for your souls. It's not enough to just say, I believe Jesus existed. I believe maybe he had some powers, but I'm going to live over here and do whatever and I'll find rest. No, you won't. There is no rest apart from Jesus because he is not only the way, he's also the truth and the life. And no one comes to the Father but through him. And we'll see later in chapter 3, Naomi, deep in her heart, really did feel it was her responsibility to find rest for her daughters-in-law. She says it. She's like, I have to find it for you. She knew that was her duty. She knew that was the calling that God had placed on her life. But right here, she's angry. She's bitter. She's concerned about her feelings, not their future. And she's still not trusting the Lord. Verse 10, and they said to her, we insist on returning with you to your people. This is a remarkable moment. Again, it's not that we're trying to beat up on Naomi, but this is hard to watch. Orpah and Ruth, Moabitesses, they're coming to her and they respond emphatically. They say, no, on the contrary, that's what they say here. We are coming with you. Essentially, they say, where must we go to be saved? What if the Philippian jailer said to Paul, what must I do to be saved? Leave me alone. Gosh, my arms and my legs hurt from being in the stocks. We'd be mortified. We'd be horrified. And they're saying, no, we will have to go with you. Yahweh, you told us about Yahweh, and now you're saying that Yahweh is providing for his people. We want to become his people. We don't even know what that means. We imagine it's going to be pretty difficult, but we want to come with you. Where must we go to be saved? But Naomi, she's not really walking with the Lord, not in faith, not in trust. And so here's her response, verse 11. But Naomi replied, return home, my daughters. Why do you want to go with me? Am I able to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. Go on, for I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me to have a husband tonight and bear sons, would you be willing to wait for them and grow up? Would you restrain yourselves from remarrying? No, my daughters. My life is much too bitter for you to share because the Lord's hand has turned against me. Okay. So she uses a three-pronged attack to try to convince them to leave. Her response can be paraphrased and restated and boiled down to this. You are wrong to go with me. You should not go. There is no point to it. Frankly, it's shocking on the lips of an Israelite. Blind mole rat mothers. You think, well, they've lived by themselves all the time. How come they aren't just extinct? Well, they do have young. They'll tend their young for a while, but eventually they become so hostile to them, they force them out of her tunnel. And that's what's happening here. Naomi is lost in the dark, full of sorrow and hopelessness. But by pushing Orpah and Ruth away, she's not only going to harm them, she's going to harm herself too. As we'll see through this book, Naomi is only saved because of the work God does through Ruth's life. Naomi's future is only secure because of what God wanted to do through that next generation. And so she's actually harming herself as she pushes these ladies away. Now she gives various reasons. Oh, here's three reasons. This, this, and this. All these reasons. She's throwing up this smoke screen. You shouldn't come with me. But did you notice she ignores the one option that is actually going to happen, the one option that's actually going to work out, the chance that a kinsman redeemer would intervene, of which we will see there are multiple in the family. And you know what? Naomi knew there were multiple kinsmen redeemers in this family. These families were large and well-connected. The communities were small. The families were large. Everybody knew each other. She knows who the kinsmen redeemers are. As soon as a name is referenced in the next chapters, oh, him, he's a kinsman redeemer. And we'll see there's another guy who could have been a kinsman redeemer. There's at least two. There might have been more. And did you notice she didn't bring that up at all? The one option that was realistic, the one option that could work, she says, well, I can't have sons that would become your kinsman redeemer and you wouldn't wait around for them. And they don't need to wait around. There's other guys who could be your kinsman redeemer right here, right now. But it's interesting. If you're a person who doesn't trust the Lord and doesn't really obey the Lord and don't take your responsibilities towards others in relation to the Lord seriously, she's probably thinking, well, why would anyone else? I'm not really willing to trust the Lord to provide for me. So why would someone else become the kinsman redeemer like they're supposed to? And so we see this mentality is having a terrible negative impact on her relationships with these ladies. She reveals why she thinks the situation is hopeless, because the Lord's hand has turned against me. Is that what happened? She accuses God of injustice here. That God took time out of his busy schedule to personally attack her. Now, I get it. She feels the terrible sorrow of the loss of her husband, the loss of her sons. That's not a small thing. But she turns around and says, God is unjust. He personally attacked me. His hand turned against me and I did nothing wrong. Is that what happened? Did his hand turn against her and Elimelech, or did their feet turn away from him? Well, we read it right in verses 1 and 2. Did God drive them out of Bethlehem, the place where he was even now providing for his people graciously and kindly, even during the time of the judges, where so many people were full of idolatry and bloodshed and godlessness? Did he drive them out, or did they abandon the covenant? Did they say, we're done here. We don't want to be in contract with Yahweh anymore. We're going to go try out Chemosh for a while. What really happened? You know, this is a book of dialogue. 55 out of the 85 verses are dialogue. Sadly, this right here, 11 through 13, is Naomi's longest speech in the book. And she uses it to denounce God's fairness, his goodness, his ability to truly deliver them from their tragedy. Now, we have to kind of lay bare Naomi's perspective here in chapter 1. Things are going to be great for Naomi by the end. Because the story of Ruth is not only the story of God's providence and not only the story of, you know, the saving of a pagan woman into the family of God, it's also about the restoration of Naomi. Naomi, who starts this far away from the Lord, being restored not only into fellowship with her family, her tribe, her clan, but also fellowship and worship of the Lord. Meanwhile, what had God done? He sent food to Bethlehem when they needed it, and he sent word to Elimelech's family, even though they're way out there. He says, hey, the Lord's like, okay, let's get food to Bethlehem, and then while we're at it, make sure they find out about it way over there. Somebody's going to have to cross the Jordan to bring the good news to Naomi that I'll provide for them still, even though they turn their backs on me, even though they don't trust me, even though they accuse me, send the good news that I will save them if they are willing. And we'll see he was doing a lot more than just sending grain and sending a message behind the scenes on behalf of these ladies specifically. Verse 14, again, they wept loudly and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Naomi said, look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Follow your sister-in-law. We shouldn't be too hard on Orpah. She obeys her mother-in-law's demands and commands, right? All right, I'll go back. We can be a little harder on Naomi, at least today. Earlier, when she was putting a spiritual spin on her words, what did she say? Oh, the Lord supply you with what you need for your future. Oh, the Lord give you hesed. Oh, the Lord do this and that. What does she say here? Just go back to your gods. Oh, my goodness. You know, people talk today about how things that people say or post online can get them canceled. This is a pretty bad thing for an Israelite to say. You know, you can see her running for, you know, city council of Bethlehem. Did you say, go back and worship the gods of Moab? And she'd have to go and do the press conference. I deeply regret my earlier post, you know. To tell someone to go back to the Moabite gods, to go back to Chemosh, who would demand that if Ruth ever had a baby, she would have to burn that baby alive on his molten arms. It is almost unspeakable for a person who knows the God of Israel, who knows Yahweh, to say, just go back to Chemosh. Just follow. Just go back there. It's fine. We'll hear Ruth's response next time. But for now, we see what she does. She clings to Naomi. Despite all Naomi was saying, despite how she was pushing. And the word used there is a strong one. It speaks of the kind of closeness found in a marriage relationship. She cleaved to her. Ruth was devoted in heart, in mind, in body to Naomi, her people, and her God, the one true God. Even if Naomi said, I don't want you with me. She said, hey, I'm in. I'm a buyer. You don't want me with you? I want to be with you. And we'll see her wonderful poem next time. Ruth would find a true home in Bethlehem. Even as they spoke, God was preparing a place of rest for her. Jesus Christ has the same kind of love and intention for you. He has invited you to make your home in him, and he wants to make his home in you. He said in Revelation chapter 3, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I'll come in to him and eat with him and he with me. And so the Lord says, hey, come be in Christ, be in me. Make your home in me. I'll give you rest, rest for your souls. I'll give you a future. I'll give you provision. I'll give you the work of my providence. And I want to make my home in you to indwell your heart. The world around you may try to dissuade you. Your family may try to stop you. Your own hurts or doubts or sorrows might be whispering to your heart not to trust in Jesus. But he is the God of Hesed love. And he is the only one who can give you rest. And our choice is to trust him, to follow him, to believe him, even when everything around us tells us not to.